You know, if you sit down and talk to experienced real estate investors long enough, like maybe over a coffee or a late dinner, you will eventually discover a very reassuring secret.
Oh yeah, the big equalizer.
Right. Almost every single one of them. I mean, no matter how incredibly successful they are today, they have made an absolutely brutally expensive mistake.
It really is the great equalizer in the property world. You know, everyone eventually pays tuition to the market. The cost of that tuition just depends entirely on what kind of asset you bought into.
I love that phrasing so much, you know, paying tuition, because looking back, they'll always tell you those mistakes seem just glaringly obvious now, the structural issues, the terrible locations. But I mean, in the moment,
Oh, in the moment, it's completely different.
right, when the brochures are glossy and the real estate agent is just hyping up the neighborhood and the market is running incredibly hot, those mistakes rarely feel like mistakes. They feel like this once in a lifetime opportunity that you'd just be an absolute fool to pass up.
Which is really the fundamental reason we are examining this entire landscape today. Property investing is, at its core, it's a cultivated skill. It is not some innate talent you're born with.
Exactly.
And like any skill, it is developed through trial, error, and, well, experience. Most people begin this journey with very limited practical knowledge, which forces them to learn the hard way how to assess risk, evaluate an opportunity's true worth, and, most importantly, separate genuine underlying potential from, you know, very clever marketing promises.
And because real estate involves some pretty astronomical numbers, learning the hard way can literally wipe out your savings.
Yeah.
But there is good news for you, the learner listening to us today. Those expensive mistakes, they actually follow highly predictable, almost rhythmic patterns.
They absolutely do.
So today, our mission is to extract those predictable mechanics behind these costly errors. We are pulling insights from a really comprehensive industry guide detailing the 7 property investment mistakes new investors should avoid, along with some fascinating cutting-edge research into fractional ownership and investor education from Usul Ghema.
It's a great combination of
It
sources.
really is. We want to give you the ultimate shortcut, allowing you to approach future opportunities with a skeptical, seasoned eye. Okay, let's unpack this.
The overarching theme to keep in mind here is that understanding the mechanisms of a bad deal, like how it is constructed and why it appeals to our psychology, that's your best defense mechanism. If you can see the bear trap before you step in it, you preserve your capital for a better path.
Let's start with what I like to call the spreadsheet trap. It's just human nature to look for an easy, digestible metric to compare two completely different things,
Oh,
right?
100%.
When you're shopping for a TV, you look at the screen size. When you're shopping for properties, people naturally gravitate straight to the financial projections. They zero in on that top line rental income number and the projected yield, and they just make their decision right there.
Well, returns provide this seductively simple way to compare wildly different opportunities side by side. It makes a duplex in one city look directly comparable to a commercial space in another.
Even though they're completely different animals.
Right. The fundamental flaw in this thinking is that a projected return is not a concrete reality. It is a mathematical hypothesis. It relies on several different, highly volatile variables all working perfectly in tandem.
It's like buying a flashy, high horsepower sports car solely because of its top speed. You see 200 miles per hour on the spec sheet and you just sign the check.
And you ignore everything else.
Exactly. You completely ignore the reality of owning that machine. Like, it requires a specialized mechanic that lives three towns over, it gets terrible gas mileage, and it costs an absolute fortune to insure. But, you know, to take that analogy even closer to real estate, it's really like dealing with a leaky bucket.
I love that. The leaky bucket is the perfect visualization of gross yield versus net yield, which is exactly where new investors just hemorrhage money.
Yes, let's define those.
Let's define them because they are crucial. Gross yield is the total amount of rent you collect in the year divided by the purchase price of the property. That is the massive hose pouring water into the top of your bucket. That is the, you know, the big bold number on the glossy brochure.
So if a property costs $500,000 and it brings in $50,000 a year in rent, your gross yield is 10%. Which, I mean, that sounds incredible on paper.
It does sound incredible, but net yield is the water that is actually left in the bucket after all the leaks have done their damage. And those leaks are the operating expenses.
Right.
You have property management fees, which can easily eat up 8 to 10% of your rent right off the bat. You have property taxes, massive insurance premiums, homeowners association fees, And, well, the inevitable cost of maintenance. A new roof, a broken boiler, repairing a water leak.
Not to mention vacancy periods. Every month that property sits empty between tenants is a massive hole in the bottom of that bucket. So that 10% gross yield could very easily mutate into a, you know, a 3 or 4% net yield once reality sets in.
What's fascinating here is that experienced investors spend just as much time auditing the physical condition of the property and the neighborhood dynamics as they do looking at the spreadsheet. They are actively hunting for those hidden leaks.
Well, that's a great point.
Yeah, and our source material actually poses a brilliant stress test for this exact scenario. You have to look at the opportunity and ask yourself, would you still be interested in this specific property if the projected returns were completely removed from the conversation entirely?
Wow. If you literally erased the yield from the page, would you still want to own this building? Because if your only reason for buying is a hypothetical number on a spreadsheet, you're completely disconnected from the real-world asset.
Exactly. And being disconnected from the real-world asset makes you incredibly vulnerable to our next major pitfall, which is the illusion of market hype.
Right. So if the spreadsheet looks perfect because the projected income is through the roof, why might that still be a terrible deal? Usually it's because that high income is a temporary illusion created by market hype and, you know, the fear of missing out, FOMO.
When a specific neighborhood or a new massive development is trending in the media, it creates an artificial sense of momentum. Say a massive tech company announces a new headquarters, or a city approves a sprawling new transit hub, and suddenly the area is highly visible. It feels impossible to ignore.
Okay, but wait, let me play devil's advocate for a second here. Because if everyone is talking about a new development or a massive new transit hub going in, doesn't that mean momentum is basically guaranteed?
Yeah.
I mean, shouldn't you follow the crowd because the infrastructure and the demand are undeniably going to be there?
Look, it sounds incredibly logical, but the mechanics of real estate pricing work against the retail investor in this scenario. By the time that transit hub makes the evening news or, you know, trends on social media, the market has already priced in the good news.
How does that actually happen behind the scenes, though? Like, who is doing the pricing in?
Institutional investors, massive developers, and seasoned insiders who actually track municipal zoning meetings. They knew about the transit hub 2 years before it hit the headlines.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they bought up the surrounding land when it was cheap. So now that the news is public and the hype is at its peak, they are the ones selling those properties to the new excited investors at a massive premium.
So by following the crowd, you aren't actually riding the wave of appreciation. You are essentially the exit strategy for the professionals who bought in early.
That is the harsh reality. You are paying top dollar for future potential that has already been baked into today's purchase price. This leaves virtually no room for your investment to actually grow. The source really emphasizes that excitement and investment quality are rarely the same thing.
Yeah, they're often opposites.
Exactly. The strongest locations are often those where positive economic trends have taken root quietly, well before the wider market has recognized them. The key test to apply here is, would this investment still look attractive if nobody else was discussing it?
It's the difference between bliss of stock, just because your neighbor told you it's going to the moon, versus bezzing it because you've methodically read the last 5 years of their earnings reports and understand their supply chain. So if we can't trust the headline returns, and we can't trust the trending neighborhoods on the news, what can we trust? What is the actual anchor here?
The anchor is the fundamental why. Understanding exactly how tenant demand is created and, equally important, defining your own personal objectives as an investor. Demand is really the heartbeat of real estate. A property only generates reliable income because human beings actively choose to live there, work there, or operate a business from that specific physical space.
Right. Strong occupancy rates aren't just magic. A tenant needs a compelling reason to choose your property over the hundreds of other options on the market. So what does this all mean? Well, if we are talking residential, you have to look at proximity. Is it a 10-minute walk to a highly rated school? Are there reliable transport links to the city center?
And for commercial real estate, it's about visibility, foot traffic, and logistics. The properties that perform best over a 30-year horizon are rarely the ones with the most avant-garde architecture or, like, the flashiest amenities.
Right, they're the boring ones.
Yes. There are properties located in areas with a clear, inescapable demographic need for the exact space they provide.
Here's a challenge for you as you evaluate your next opportunity. Imagine sitting down with someone who has zero real estate experience, like a complete novice, and explaining the investment to them. Could you articulate exactly why a family would choose to rent this specific house?
That's a great thought experiment.
If your only argument is, well, the brochure says the yield is 8%, you don't actually understand the demand. You need to be able to say, they will rent this house because it is one block from the best elementary school in the district, and the city has heavily restricted new family home construction in this zip code.
That thoroughly covers the tenant side of the equation. But our source material is very clear that you also have to define the investor's why. Entering the market before you have clearly identified your own financial goals is a total recipe for disaster.
Yeah, people just dive in blindly.
People see an attractive property, the math seems vaguely reasonable, and they purchase it without asking what role this asset is actually supposed to play in their broader life.
Because different goals require completely, entirely different property types. Our source breaks this down into a really helpful matrix of four distinct investment strategies. Let's walk through the mechanics of these. First, you have income.
Right. If your primary goal is income, your entire focus needs to be on stable rental demand and consistent cash flow. You are looking for low vacancy risk. You want the boring, reliable property that consistently spits out a check every single month to supplement your salary.
But the second goal in the matrix is long-term growth. And this is practically the complete opposite strategy.
It is. If growth is your objective, today's cash flow is secondary. You are hunting for future appreciation potential. You are looking for areas undergoing early economic expansion, maybe a neighborhood going through a massive rezoning process.
So you might not make much month to month.
You might buy a property that barely breaks even month to month, absorbing that financial strain because your data suggests the underlying land value will double in a decade.
That carries a lot more risk, obviously. Then we have the third objective, diversification. This is someone who already has a lot of capital, maybe heavily tied up in the stock market, and they just want exposure to physical assets,
yeah,
you know, to balance their portfolio against a stock market crash.
Which leads directly into the fourth objective, which is wealth preservation. This is the defensive play. For wealth preservation, you are targeting established blue chip markets.
Let's define blue chip in a real estate context for a second, because that's a term usually thrown around with stocks.
In real estate, a blue chip market is a highly desirable, globally recognized location with a long proven history of stable prices, even during economic downturns. Think prime central real estate in major global hubs. The yields are typically very low because the purchase prices are astronomically high.
Right.
But you aren't buying there to get rich quick. You're buying there to park your capital safely. A great example of wealth preservation is buying a commercial building and leasing it to a massive corporate pharmacy on a 15-year contract.
It's definitely not glamorous. The yield is tiny.
But that corporate pharmacy pays the rent on time every single month, they handle their own maintenance, and they don't close their doors during a recession. It is a financial fortress. Now, the critical takeaway from this matrix is that a good property is entirely subjective.
Oh, absolutely.
A high-yield residential unit in a rapidly gentrifying, highly volatile neighborhood might be a fantastic choice for an aggressive growth investor, but it would be a catastrophic choice for a retiree whose only goal is to preserve their life savings without stress.
You really have to know your own matrix before you even start looking at listings. Okay, so mapping this out. You need to deeply research the hidden expenses to find your true net yield. You have to completely ignore the market hype by understanding how institutional buyers price things in. You have to figure out exactly what drives local tenant demand, and you have to align the asset with your personal financial matrix.
A lot.
That is a staggering amount of due diligence, which brings up a very real psychological barrier, the pressure of time.
The real estate industry is uniquely skilled at creating artificial urgency. Opportunities hit the market, brokers tell you there are three other offers on the table, and that FOMO creeps right back in. You start convincing yourself that if you don't waive your inspections and act right this second, you will miss the deal of the decade.
But meticulously analyzing the leaky buckets and the neighborhood demographics takes time. The required due diligence fundamentally clashes with the market's pressure to act fast.
And that collision is exactly where investors get hurt the most. They capitulate to the pressure and move forward before they truly understand the mechanics of the asset. Assumptions go unchallenged and structural risks are ignored. A seasoned investor views time as an ally, not an enemy.
Yeah.
They do not feel pressure to pursue every single deal because they understand a fundamental truth. There will always be another opportunity. Their priority is not speed. Their priority is conviction.
Patience is incredibly hard to practice, especially when you are eager to get your foot in the door. But here's where it gets really interesting. If analyzing all of these variables feels totally overwhelming and you are terrified of making a catastrophic mistake on your first whole property, the industry is actually evolving.
Yes, thankfully.
There are modern ways to gain exposure, learn the ropes, and analyze real deals without having to buy an entire building yourself. Our sources highlight the rise of fractional property ownership.
For many individuals, the most significant hurdle isn't a lack of interest. It is the massive barrier to entry. Fractional ownership structures alter that dynamic entirely. Instead of buying a whole property, you are purchasing equity shares in an income-generating asset alongside other investors.
It's important to clarify what this is not, though. This isn't a timeshare where you get to stay in a vacation home for a week.
No, not at all.
You are buying actual equity in an investment vehicle that owns the real estate. You get to see the mechanics of the market in action, and you collect your fraction of the rent, but you aren't personally getting a phone call at 2 a.m. because a pipe burst.
The source points to a very relevant real-world evolution of this concept by highlighting Osul Gamma, a platform focusing heavily on investor education and transparent data within the fractional space. What is particularly notable is that their offering is currently being tested within Rijiyeh's regulatory sandbox in Saudi Arabia.
Let's pause and explain the sandbox concept, because that's a brilliant mechanism for both innovation and protection. For those who don't know, a regulatory sandbox is essentially a safe, tightly controlled environment created by financial authorities.
Right.
It allows new financial technologies like fractional real estate platforms to be tested live with real users, but under strict regulatory supervision before they are unleashed on the wider general market.
It acts as a proving ground. It ensures that the legal structures protecting the investors are robust and that the platforms are operating transparently. It shows a systemic push to democratize real estate access. However, the source material introduces a massive caveat here, referencing detailed analyses like understanding fractional property ownership in Saudi Arabia and how Saudi investors can own fractional shares in real estate.
Yes, this is crucial.
The core takeaway from both is that fractional ownership lowers the financial barrier, but it does not lower the analytical requirement.
Buying a fraction of a bad deal is still a bad deal.
Precisely the point. The exact same principles we have discussed apply. You still need to scrutinize the gross versus net yield of the overarching property. You still need to understand if the property is located near those highly rated schools or if it is just a product of trending market hype.
It's just a different vehicle for the exact same fundamental asset class. But by utilizing platforms operating in these transparent sandbox environments, you can start building your analytical muscles incrementally.
No.
You can practice aligning a smaller investment with your wealth matrix without, you know, betting your entire life savings on your very first evaluation.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it provides a practical education. You learn to read the market signals with lower capital risk.
So bring this all together for you today. Investing in property is always going to be an exercise in making large decisions with imperfect information. You will never have a crystal ball, and you will never eliminate risk entirely. The goal of studying these predictable mistakes isn't to become perfectly flawless for the rest of your life.
No, the objective is to approach opportunities systematically, to force yourself to question your own assumptions, to look past the glossy brochures, ignore the short-term sentiment driving the headlines, and focus intently on the unglamorous underlying mechanics of long-term performance.
You want to find the solid buckets with no leaks.
Exactly. Property investing is not a static event. It is a process of continuous adaptation. The macroeconomic environment evolves, zoning laws change, and the investors who preserve and grow their capital are the ones who remain disciplined and endlessly curious.
And speaking of the environment evolving, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over. We spent a lot of time today talking about how tenant demand is driven by physical proximity. Being geographically close to the good schools, the massive corporate office parks, the heavy foot traffic.
Right, the traditional drivers.
Historically, physical location has been the undeniable anchor of real estate value. But look at how rapidly our reality is fracturing and changing. With the explosive permanent rise of remote work, the integration of artificial intelligence into our daily routines, and the creation of entirely digital decentralized communities, how will the very definition of tenant demand fundamentally mutate over the next decade?
It challenges the very foundation of the asset class. I mean, if the necessity to commute vanishes, the premium paid for proximity vanishes with it.
Exactly. What if the reasons human beings choose to gather completely change? Will the perfect location of today, that ultra-premium, high-priced downtown commercial center, become the abandoned shopping mall of tomorrow simply because physical proximity to an office building is no longer a requirement for a high-paying career? As you develop your skills and methodically try to avoid the expensive mistakes of the past, remember that the most devastating mistake of the future might just be assuming that human demand will always look exactly the way it does right now. You have to keep learning, keep questioning the consensus, keep looking past the spreadsheet.